we want to make sure that they're able to create their first impression of what this space provides, and we want to tell that narrative. And by doing so, we're able to put that right in front of people immediately. You know, the other part is we want people to come in and be educated. We don't want them to come in to the buying process and feeling like that first discovery call is like a huge overload and overbearing amount of learning and trying to understand what we're trying to tell them. No, we've crafted a story that allows you to understand what it is, and then you can come in saying, I'm already thinking about how I'm going to use Vitally. Tell me the story of how you would sell it to me and how I would use it.
Everybody, welcome back to Product Marketing Life, the podcast where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. My name is Colin Majak. I'm a lead PMM at Classy GoFundMe. And in this episode, I got a chance to sit down with Jeff Chase, Mary Lim, and Rachel Sheldon, also known as the product marketing team at Vitally. And this episode was a lot of fun. We dove into all things interactive storytelling and product adoption. And the Vitally team shared a bit about how their team built their interactive demos from the ground up, the role that those demos play in their customer journey, and how they build product guides that don't get ignored and X'd out just like a pop-up. I really enjoyed this episode, and I think you will too. Enjoy the episode. Hey, Jeff, Mary, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's good to actually meet the three of you. I feel like Jeff and Mary in particular, I feel like I've been following you guys on LinkedIn for a while, so it feels strange to actually meet you in real life via a screen.
Yeah, I mean, same here. I've been, you know, seeing a lot of your posts lately, so it's exciting to actually put, you know, face-to-face. So I'm excited to chat today.
Yeah, I'm in particular excited because I think this is the first time I've had an entire product marketing team, assuming we're not missing anyone. I think this is your whole like PMM team on a podcast. So that's super exciting. I've had like one or two people at times, but could the three of you just quickly sort of introduce yourself and then share a little bit of what you do on the team?
So I can start out. So my name is Jeff Chase. I am our director of brand and product marketing at Vitally. So my role is one, leading the product marketing team, which includes Mary and Rachel here, who will introduce themselves, but really working closely cross-functionally with the entire organization on, you know, bringing products to market, helping positioning and messaging, and really helping just shape what Vitally is outside to the market. And then, as I mentioned, I have that brand marketing side as well. So not joining us today are the two visual designers on our team, Laura and Melissa, but we also have a brand design aspect of the team, which really leans well into like the product marketing approach that we've taken as an organization.
My name is Mary. I'm a product marketing manager at Vitally. I actually started my career off in hospitality, so in hotels and restaurants, and then eventually made my way into tech. But at Vitally, I am mainly focused on sales enablement. So everything on the pre-sale side, competitive intel, creating content, helping out with launches as well. But yeah, everything under that bucket.
Hi, I'm Rachel Sheldon. I'm also a product marketing manager on the team. And I'm sort of Mary's post-sale counterpart. So everything having to do with product launches, customer enablement, customer education, working on internal enablement, so training our own team, that all kind of falls under my realm. I have a background in customer education specifically, so taking that skill set into this role in Vitally as well.
Cool. Okay, Jeff, you hinted at this before we started the call, but I've never heard of a team splitting between pre-sales and post-sales. In that way, often you'll hear inbound, outbound PMM or by function or by product. I feel like that's the most, by product is the most typical part that I see. And Rachel, you hinted at it with your background, but I'm wondering what led you to split the team that way?
Yeah, it's definitely a unique way that we've approached it. I think one potential reason for like what leans into it is the nature of the product that we sell. So Vitally is a customer success platform. So we really want to be able to relate closely back to our key persona. And so what Rachel on her side, which she does a lot of work on, is one, really understanding like who our customers are, but also really understanding who our team is. And, you know, that's a lot of work to be able to kind of underdo under one person. But the other thing that's really interesting to me is that the perspectives of the persona and the buyer and the end user is very different in the pre-sales and the post-sales stages. And you're talking to two very different people. And so when I thought about taking this approach, what I really wanted to do was have one person that's super obsessed with what is it like to be, you know, a prospect to Vitaly, and like, you know, understanding what the competitors are and understanding, you know, the pain points and the frustrations that are going through, and then having another person that's obsessed with, what am I doing as a customer of Vitaly? And like, how do I use the product and how do I get the most out of it? Because the perspectives that you go through in those two different stages are very different. You know, you're not, after you've kind of bought a product, yes, sometimes you do revisit and start looking at competitors or start to look through your pain points again. But typically you've moved into a new stage where you're going to adoption and you're really trying to get the most out of this product, this experience. And you're kind of taking this next stage in the customer journey to where you'll be growing and continue to grow from there.
Cool. Mary, I feel like I've heard folks draw the connection between hospitality and the onboarding experience of like, hey, you finally came in our door, so to speak, of purchase. And now we're going to walk you through. I'm curious, do you feel like you see dots connecting between that experience and what you're now doing with that focus on pre-sales and thinking about the buying process as well?
I think so. I think there's definitely similarities between like providing a good customer experience, which is what you're always trying to do, whether you're at a hotel or at a restaurant, like that's the main driver. And then also just like setting processes in place as well. Like it's important to standardize things. So there's definitely like a lot of crossover from hospitality to onboarding.
And then Rachel, you said your background was customer marketing. Yeah.
Customer education.
Okay. So how much overlap are you feeling with that customer education role and what you're doing now?
There's a lot of overlap. So previously, I was at HubSpot working on the HubSpot Academy team. So developing a lot of certifications, courses, doing a lot of video content over there. And I've taken a lot of that into this role, specifically like honing in on the product and doing product education, but also creating all that video content and working really closely with our customer success team to sort of bring out the knowledge and the expertise that they have on that side. Since, you know, we are our best customer, we're a customer success team selling a customer success product. So really letting them shine there. And that's been a big focus of mine.
Cool. I like that idea of trying to borrow from the parts of that persona that you sell to in-house. Someone who works in sales technology, not consulting with their sales team, it feels like it's the most readily available like persona feedback that you could get. That's super helpful. One other thing that stood out to me about the way your team is structured is, Jeff, I've noticed that your title, you mentioned this earlier, is both brand, director of brand and product marketing, which I feel like is not a combo I see a lot. In fact, I feel like sometimes PMM and brand marketers sort of dog on each other. Like on one side, you have PMMs that think brand is too woo-woo and needs to talk about the product. And then brand on the other side is often thinking product is too product focused. You're talking about yourself too much and doesn't think about the role that even emotion and brand affinity can play in buying decisions. I'd be curious, can you share a little bit of how you've thought about the relationship between brand and product marketing and bringing those two together?
Yeah. I mean, I think the genesis of really my approach to it was exactly the problems you laid out, which is a lot of times product marketing and brand marketing can feel a bit disconnected. I think that, you know, and I'm going to talk from the perspective of B2B SaaS, but a lot of times brand marketing, the B2B SaaS side tends to lead to more like a vaporware type of approach, I find. Like, you know, a lot of times a brand is a little more floofy and it feels like there's a lot of like fluff and kind of like air kind of put in there that doesn't really truly define like what your product is. And when you're in the B2B SaaS space, your best marketing asset is your product. And so the thing that I really wanted to focus on was how do I really bring the product forward in what our brand is, but also have a brand that really tells a story, really resonates with the market. And when you really think about at the end of the day, if you're trying to talk about your product, you're trying to talk about your ICP, you're trying to talk about the pain points, you're trying to understand what your competitors are doing, there's no team that's any better or closer to that than your product marketing organization. Now, I might be in a unique situation because my past started in like doing some design work. And so I also have a close connection to understanding like brands and like what good design looks like. And so that's just a unique part to me. But, you know, when I came into Vitally, I was the third marketing hire. And what I set out from the beginning was I really want to own the website. I really want to own the brand. I want to help define these things because I want the message to connect from the moment you first interact with Vitally and discover it as a brand to the moment you go through the sales conversation to the moment you buy the product. Those journeys all connect. They don't disconnect. And so that was really important to me when I was kind of really putting this together. And it's worked out really well. And as I mentioned earlier, like we have two more additional members on my team, Laura and Melissa, who are our visual designers. And they're almost extensions of our product marketing team. They really understand the product well. They understand the personas well. They're taking in requests from us and they're able to go right off of that because they're already connected within the product marketing organization. And we really keep them well versed in what we're doing. And it's allowed our brand, I believe, to really differentiate and stand out in what can be a somewhat crowded market. And it's something that we'll continue to build on. And, you know, I think a lot of things we'll talk about today, from product tours to positioning and messaging, interactive experiences, has really allowed us to really blend that brand experience with the product and messaging experience that I think is really essential to communicate your value back to customers.
As you talked about that, I had this realization about my own experience working with brands. So I do not have design chops or design background. And so God bless people who do, because I need those people. But I feel like my experience as a PMM is a lot of times I'm writing this messaging about the product that I feel like resonates with the customer, accurately describes what our product does. And then I'm kind of throwing it over the wall to brand, to put it on the website and just hoping like, please don't butcher this, or like, please don't like squish it into like and cut out key details about the product or about the positioning. And so feeling that experience over and over again, like anytime I create messaging, I'm hoping it like survives that jump. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense then to think about it as that whole experience of like someone experiences us through our product and through our entire digital footprint, and to bring coherency across that, to have those kind of report up. That makes a ton of sense to me. But something you hinted at was that you guys have leaned heavily into kind of interactive storytelling and product tours and trying to bring the product forward. And that's been the main kind of, that's what you've taken on as one of your main jobs. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have all of you on, is we'll come back to customers in a moment. But I just want to think about the prospect journey. If people go to Vitally's site, which I did prepping this, they'll see a really well thought out interactive demo. Like, it's very thorough and well done. And so I'd be curious, thinking about the foundational decision making, what made you all decide it was worth putting in the effort to have an interactive demo? Because there's internal convincing you need to do, there's actual work to execute it, there's finding a vendor, all of that. Like, it's not a small task. So what was kind of the deciding factor on that front?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to start it off, but I'd love Mary to, you know, chime in here, and she'll be able to cover a lot more. She's our internal owner of our interactive tours, and we use Novatic, which is a really great partner vendor of ours. But I think the big reason why we went down the interactive product tour route and has also made it really visible on our website is we want to win in that first impression. When you go through the buyer journey, when you're looking for a new product, you're not just going to one site saying, this is the one I want, I want to take a demo. You're booking a demo, you're looking at all the different competitors, and then the waiting game starts. Okay, I submit a demo request to three different companies. Who's going to follow up with me first? Who's going to get that first foot in the door to tell me like what their product does and set the stage and set that ground floor and like what's the differentiators? Who's going to win? And so what we've really done is we've tried to set that level from the get-go. We make product tours a very visible part of the buyer experience. So when you come onto our website, it has equal footing to booking a demo and taking a product tour. After you've booked a demo with us, the first prompt you get is, can't wait to talk to you. Here's a product demo. And we want to get that in front of people because we want to make sure that they're able to create their first impression of what this space provides. And we want to tell that narrative. And by doing so, we're able to put that right in front of people immediately. You know, the other part is we want people to come in and be educated. We don't want them to come in to the buying process and feeling like that first discovery call is like a huge overload and overbearing amount of learning and trying to understand what we're trying to tell them. No, we've crafted a story that allows you to understand what it is. And then you can come in saying, I'm already thinking about how I'm going to use Vitally. tell me the story of how you would sell it to me and how I would use it. And that's the genesis of why we started with it. But we'd love for Mary to kind of take it from there, because she's really the one who's crafted a lot of these stories, done a really great job building it out.
Yeah, Mary, I'd be curious, with some of that background reasoning, like what were some of kind of the guiding principles that you had in mind as you were even building out that demo?
Yeah, I think Novatic themselves, they provided a lot of good resources to help you get started on like what's best practice. You know, you want not too much text or not too many steps on a demo in order to keep people engaged. And so I think we had a pretty good starting point from there. And it was just a matter of creating a bunch of demos. I've created over 50 demos now in our Novatic account.
That's a lot of demos. So
it's a lot, but you learn over time, like, okay, this is kind of where people are dropping off. You know, this having people click or type in something makes it a bit more interactive and kind of shows them and tells them at the same time.
Yeah. Were those 50 iterations of what lived on your site, or were you finding that you were spinning off demos for, hey, this enterprise rep wants a customized demo, can you spin one up? Like, is there an alternate use case coming up there?
So we used interactive demos for a couple different things. So one, which you probably saw, is just doing the overall platform demo and then also feature specific demos. But then we also use them in our blueprints, which show customer success use cases. So those are like the other 40 that are available.
Okay. That's super helpful. Now, transparently, I've never built an interactive demo on a website, which I do feel a little embarrassed to admit. Conceptually, I am all for it. But I want to run through some of the concerns that I feel like I've had, and also more so that I feel like I've seen have come up when I've tried proposing it in the past. And the first one is primarily a sales concern. And Jeff, you hinted at this a little bit. I've encountered sales leaders who don't want to provide a demo on the site, or Jeff would push back on that idea of like sending the demo after someone has booked to talk to a rep, because they're afraid it would actually decrease how many prospects get on a call with reps. It's almost like there's this fear, like you're giving away all the goods, so why would they talk to us, sort of thing. And so I'm curious if you got that concern or not. And if not, how would you handle that question? I mean, even zooming out further, did you see any actual effect on pipeline from building these demos? So I realize that's a question stacked. I broke all the rules. But have you encountered that objection first off?
We did not get the objection. Our team was super excited about the prospect of having something that they can share with the customers. When we originally started with, though, it was more of like, hey, like we've already started talking to you. Here's a demo of like some certain features. Like we didn't jump like 2 feet in. Like we're putting like product tours on our website like right away.
Yeah.
We first really wanted to understand like what customers' feedback and thoughts were. And the feedback right away from the sales team was that their prospects loved it. They're like, this is really great. Like, cool. Thank you for these resources. I'm going to share them with the other people on my team who were not able to attend the calls today. So for us, it was really helpful to see that right away, because we got buy-in almost immediately. I mean, the other concern that you lead to, which is like, you know, you're afraid you're giving away too much, or, you know, you might not be able to make the sales pitch. I think that really depends on how good your product tour is. I mean, if you make a compelling enough product tour to really sell a good story and value of your product, they're not going to say, I don't want the demo. They're going to want to move forward with the conversation with you. And that goes back to what I was mentioning earlier, which is like setting the stage, setting the foundation of like, what's that, you know, bottom floor expectation of what I'm looking for in this platform. And you're able to really take advantage of that. If you're starting to see those numbers decrease, like you're seeing a lot of people take product tours, but product demo requests are going down, well, then there's certainly a drop off there where you're not communicating that value. Maybe something's too complex and you're seeing like a big loss there. Now you've hurt yourself. And maybe at that point you need to revisit your tours, you need to revisit your product. Like it's not sure like where that problem lies. But we saw a really high increase in people taking these tours, both gated and ungated versions. And we've never seen a drop off in our demo requests. In fact, like they just continue to go up and up. And as I mentioned earlier, like, you know, people are becoming more educated, and certain buying cycles is helping reduce time to purchase. And that's super important to us and like one of the values that we're trying to communicate there.
Yeah. I was curious about the actual choice to put an email collect in front of the demo, and you hinted at it. I'm imagining, did that not affect results? Because I noticed that if you go on Vitaly's website, email capture, then you can do the demo. Did that not have a consequential impact on how many people actually did the demo?
It's hard to say. I mean, we don't have a bar for like how many people would actually have done it without it. Gotcha. But there is a, there's a strategic reason for why we did it that way. What I'll say is the majority of the tours on Vitaly's website are not gated, but that one is gated. But it doesn't enroll you immediately into a demo or anything in that regard. But, you know, we still want to make sure we're capturing people's interest. But no, we haven't really seen it causing too many problems. I think that people are pretty used to, you know, putting in their information to access something. And it's up to them if they want to continue to follow through of any conversations that go from there or just ignore it. So we haven't seen too much of a drop off in that regard. But certainly when you do an ungated approach, there will be higher traffic to it, but also, you know, in my rough understanding of like what I've seen from the metrics, when it is gated, you have a little more intent. And so we do see people going further into those demos and getting more information. So there's a trade-off in that regard too.
Yeah. As someone who's not your ICP, I was thinking about that gate and thinking like, oh, do I want to insert my email here? Someone on the other side is going to throw out my email as I'm someone who's not qualified at all. Like I had that thought, but again, I'm not your ICP. So that makes sense for someone who's high intent to like, that's a negligible amount of friction. Mary, I'd be curious about your thoughts. So one of my favorite things in the demo was there was this little call out about hubs early on. And the demo explains that feature saying, quote, hubs are unique to Vitaly. And then goes on to explain what the feature does. And listeners don't even need to understand the feature, but what I appreciated was this subtle positioning take in there, where it's this little nod to, hey, only we do this. Like this is a Vitaly thing, as opposed to any of your competitors. It reminds me of something that a salesperson would do in a demo, where they would introduce a feature and then say, hey, as we're selling this, this is something that only we do, just to be aware of. Was that sort of intentional to have sort of this, did you start seeing that demo as an opportunity to sort of pitch to those who were using the demo? Was that kind of on your mind or just come out naturally?
I think half and half. So whenever we did release hubs, it was definitely a differentiator for us. And it still is for Vitaly compared to the other customer success platforms on the market. But I think as I was writing, it just kind of like, as I was describing the feature, it kind of just came out. So naturally was just there. So yeah, I appreciate that you recognize that though, Colin.
Yeah, thanks. I loved it. I loved that little nod to differentiation and introducing them. Cause I think that was like the fourth click, like third or fourth click. Like it's really early in the demo that you start hitting that differentiated value, which feels like such a, I don't know, made my little PMM heart sing. So cool. Love hearing about what you guys have done on the prospect side of things. I would love to talk a little bit about customer education and sort of the customer side of driving adoption. Now, if I remember correctly, you guys said you sell into customer success, right? Okay. So I imagine this puts a ton of pressure on nailing onboarding, because in my mind, you're selling to like the onboarding and adoption people. And so if your product doesn't onboard and help drive adoption, You're losing some credibility there. And so I would be curious what your process was. Rachel, I think this was in your sort of court for starting to think about that initial onboarding experience when someone has crossed the sales line and is actually getting into the product for the first time.
Yeah, that's definitely a great question. I mean, I have to give credit where credit is due here. We have an incredible CS team that does an amazing job of onboarding our customers. We have amazing solutions architects who implement our customers and take them through the process. And like you said, nailing that experience is really, really important to us. So that is obviously the first kind of experience that people have with our product, is directly being guided through by our team. That being said, we also want to make sure we're incorporating sort of these more touchless experiences into the product for people when, you know, they might log in without their solutions architect for the first time. We want to make sure they're having a good experience. So
yeah,
we've done a few things in that regard. We worked with the product team, going back to hubs for a second that Mary was just talking about, to have sort of initial like getting started hubs for people. When they come in, they can see some nice educational copy and some resources in there that sort of guide them through, hey, this is the core of your Vitaly experience. These are hubs. This is how you're going to use them and build them out for your team. So things like that, working closely with the product team to build in those experiences, and also using our in-app tour tool. So we use Chameleon for in-app embedded experiences and pop-ups and things like that. And we lean really heavily on that for all kind of customer education and product adoption needs.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I feel like having that view in mind of what is when the product manager built this product, what were they envisioning? Because I feel like that's something that often product is over here building something, and then over here PMM and maybe customer marketing, CS are all kind of working together to solve this adoption puzzle. And I think a lot of times the product manager doesn't get brought back in that far. Like they're in roadmap land. They're thinking about like the next release. Let's not bother them. But I think that's actually a really great perspective to bring in, because they're the person who sort of architected this area of the product. And what was their vision and the discovery they did for how someone would engage with it for the first time? Did you have any specific takeaways from that interaction? No pressure if not. I'm curious if they had any insights at the time that you thought like, oh, that was useful to pull in the PM, or I'm glad that the PM spoke to that.
Yeah, I think we definitely got really good insights from the product team, not just on that launch, but in subsequent launches since then, about, okay, this is kind of what we discovered when we did our customer research and found out what were their pain points that caused us to build this product in this particular way, and kind of digesting that information and using that to inform the decisions we're making with the in-app experiences, as well as with like our content and other assets. But yeah, we definitely try to bring the product team back in as much as possible. I definitely know what you mean. They get off into roadmap land again very quickly. Yeah. And it's our job to sort of pull them back in and say, okay, well, now we're thinking about adoption and usage, and where are people getting tripped up in the product, and how can we help them to use it better?
Yeah.
Yeah. We also benefit because like our product team, our CS team, our marketing team, we're all in Vitaly. And it's product analytics, it's customer success, it's customer comms. So, you know, luckily they are also naturally brought back into it. So it's kind of a blessing in disguise for us that everyone's constantly having visibility into like how these things are going throughout every part of the cycle.
I'm thinking through this. Can you use Vitaly to care for your Vitaly customers? Because that feels very meta, if so.
So we do.
That's amazing.
We drink our own champagne. We use Vitaly. Our whole team uses Vitaly every single day to manage our customers.
So
our product
team
uses it to manage their product releases. We use it. The CS team uses it a ton. We're all in there all the time.
Yeah, I feel like... I'll go for it, Mary.
I was going to say, even for like customer marketing, like I use it to manage our customer reference program, identify good case study candidates, and manage all of that in Vitaly.
I feel like that's a rare gift where there's not a lot of players in the space who get to actually use their product at that level. Like in my case, for example, like my company sells a fundraising platform. I am not a nonprofit fundraiser. So I don't get the native experience of using the product and then getting to bring that back to how I write about it or how we position or that sort of thing. So that feels like a really unique gift. Now, something I've noticed both as a product marketer and as someone who just uses digital products is that a lot of the in-app tours and even onboarding tactics are kind of the same couple tactics on repeat. So you get banners, pop-ups, maybe a little pulse if you're fancy, modals, tooltips, a checklist at the top. And for a long time, when you got a digital product and logged in for the first time, you were sort of just dumped right into the thing and there was no heads up and no guidance. And so initially when companies started rolling out these in-app tours, it really stood out because it was going from no instruction to instruction. Like that was like a night and day difference. So that was a huge win. But now this might just be me. Now that we've sort of become accustomed to these tools and sort of become accustomed to these this onboarding, I find myself often wanting to X out of these onboarding tools like a pop-up on a website. Like they feel like they, I feel this, I can pick on them. Well, Rachel, you worked there before. Sorry. I've did this a lot with HubSpot. So like I found myself like, they're like, do you want to do this? Absolutely not. Just let me send the email. Like I felt like it was getting in the way. So all to say, I've started to wonder, have they lost some of their effectiveness? And I'm assuming I'm not alone in feeling that way occasionally with some of these. So I'm curious, how have you guys thought about building not just in-app product tours, but just even that whole customer education after they've gotten in the product in a way that doesn't get ignored or doesn't get X'd out? Have you guys thought through that or had any particular tips you've seen be effective?
Yeah, I mean, you name it, all those things you said, we've tried all of them. Every time Chameleon comes out with a new feature, we're like the first people to use it and try it out and see, okay, does this have better engagement? Because we definitely experienced that, the tooltip fatigue of people who they just immediately dismiss something. They're so conditioned kind of as soon as something pops up to just dismiss it straight away. And we've definitely seen that. So we try to be conscientious in how often we're serving up these kind of more interactive experiences to customers, trying to use them sparingly and in ways that will have the greatest impact, use things that will draw their eye to it. So nice branding, design, gifts, things like that. And then we also try to make it more of a contextual experience. So having something that's a little bit more subtle, a little more embedded into the product and seems more just like additional help along the way rather than a more interruptive pop-up or banner type of experience. Yeah. So we've seen some success with both of those strategies.
Yeah. I like that idea of thinking about frequency. Sorry, go for it, Jeff.
Oh, yeah. This might lead into what you're going to say of frequency here, but I think one of the things that's been really unique for us, and you know, Chameleon is the first platform we're using for these interactive tours, but we use segmentation like very strongly. And so we're not just like blasting things to everyone. We're actually dialing into the audience based on what they haven't done. What are they using? Who are they? What's their role? And so we might have an alert that goes out that maybe only goes to 20% of our audience because that's who contextually needs it. We might do something that goes to everyone. And so we're also being conscientious in that way where it's like, we're just not like blasting everything to everyone, which I think can sometimes happen when you take a more generalized approach to these things. But, you know, Rachel's done a really great job of like really working closely with product and CS and understanding where are the gaps, what are the problems, and then the fact that we have so much visibility into our product usage and who our customers are, we're able to really dial it in. And that allows us to really deliver these really unique experiences that are, as Rachel mentioned, contextual, and it's led to really high click-through rates for us. It's not perfect. We're not, you know, not every single time is 100%. We do have some tours that end up being duds, but we learn from those. But it really allows us to kind of reduce that margin of what I would call error and annoyance. And it really allows us to use this tool to our advantage for the customer lifecycle. Sorry, what were you going to say there, Colin?
No, that's super helpful. The note about segmentation, I see how segmentation could naturally lead its way to doing less, right? Like at the end of the day, segmentation is contact less people, just contact the right people. And I feel like a lot of times my experience as an end user is it feels like I'm just getting spammed with tooltips. So you get to this point where it's like, I'm so accustomed to this not being that relevant to me that I'm going to ignore it. And so I like that idea of trying to think really practically about which specific segment of our customers needs to be addressed with this specific tip or this specific next step. Are you all thinking about that way back here when you're thinking about like go-to-market strategy and thinking like, all right, I'm seeing that we're launching tool X, for example. It's this tool. And we want to really put that, we want to really promote it in product to customers who have used this part of our product before, have used this product three times or more. Like, are you guys thinking about that way back here? Or is it more like product is launched and now downstream you're starting to come up with those segments? I would love to just peel back the curtain on how you're thinking about that segmentation.
I think we try to incorporate it pretty early on, especially if we're launching something that has like a natural counterpart that's already in the product. So say we're launching an enhancement to our surveys feature. We want to think about, okay, how can we get this in front of people who've maybe already published a survey, and this is going to help enable them to do XYZ with that survey that they've already published. So yeah, we're definitely thinking about that, incorporating it earlier into the kind of product launch cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to answer your question, Colin, I think both. We're, as Rachel mentioned, we're getting in very early on, and that's where we're basically in our assumption stage. And there, like, that's our hypothesis. We're going to see what happens. But yeah, a lot of the experiences that we're launching, you know, that's for just like the users on day zero. But what about the users on day 30, day 60, day 90? We have to continue to iterate. If it didn't work, if the messaging didn't resonate, we don't just say, okay, it's done. Like, we have to continue to update those things and change them. Has other aspects that are related to have changed as well. So we're also constantly iterating and like trying to improve those things, because, you know, we try to do things that live for a bit of time inside the product as well. So it's a bit of both, but I think, and this goes back to like earlier on when we talked about the split in the team, you know, Rachel's able to really embed herself with product and customer success and our customers and get obsessive over it. So then she can really understand those things early on in the process versus juggling a bunch of other things to have them be reactive. And the same thing goes on the sales enablement side for Mary with like building interactive product tours. Like, we're able to obsess over these things. And so we're able to spend that time premeditating over like, what should we do? And then learning and understanding and building from there.
Yeah. The thread that I'm hearing most consistently is that it seems like there's a lot of moments where you all have to make decisions, not just about what you are guiding your customers towards, but what you are not guiding your customers towards. And I think when you're a product marketer, you're hearing from the PMM and you're hearing from the engineers, and whatever feature they've shipped is the feature that is in their mind number one. And so you have to almost like zoom out and have this big picture view of, all right, if someone is only 30 days into our product, they don't actually need to know about, like, they don't need to get this as their primary CTA right now. Like, we still want them to focus on these foundations. Or, you know, this is something that actually, no, it does need to go to everyone. This is big enough an innovation that it needs to go to everyone. But that constant saying yes and no, so you can put the right next step in front of your customers, seems to be kind of like the through line in terms of how you're thinking about that customer education and onboarding journey. Now, when I think about the spectrum of being product led, there's full PLG. We think of Canvas and ClickUps and that sort of thing. And then there's a fully sales-led org. But I think most of us are companies that are striving to be more product-led, but are always going to have to incorporate and work with a sales-led org, or sales team rather. And I think I see you guys as advancing pretty far down the line on that spectrum. Like, you've tried to, where you can, really bring the product into the foreground, lead with the product. And that was a journey. I would be curious, as if you were looking back on the choice to bring the product into the foreground, the choice to build these interactive demos, the choice to have a more like boutique onboarding experience in the product, is there anything that the three of you would do differently or wish you did sooner?
Just done it all sooner. You know, I think that in my experience, you know, I've always have... So I come from a community background, like working like as a community manager. And so I've always led with like empathy, and really trying to think about how do we best serve the people that we're selling to. But, you know, throughout my time, like, I've kind of been a solo PMM, and so resourcing is always tough. And as I mentioned earlier, the things I was tackling. So to me, like, when I was really building out this team, I wanted to make sure we had people who could really own and be experts in these spaces. And, you know, while I kind of take back my answer, because I don't think I wish I would have done it sooner, because I don't think we would have done it right. But, you know, I think building out the team and building out the right people to own those things, doing that sooner would have led to even greater results. But I think the time that we took to do it and do it right has really had really great results for us. So yeah, kind of like a little bit of 360 moment there for me where I just went through it. Yeah. So I guess I wouldn't have done anything differently. But
so you nailed
I'm very happy with it. Yeah, I nailed it, I guess. You know, that's how it works out. But yeah, I think it's really worked out well. But, you know, I think from both Rachel and Mary's perspectives, you know, they've built a lot of these programs from the ground up. Would love their perspective, like if they would have done anything differently. But yeah.
I don't think I would do anything differently. Kind of similar to what Jeff has said, like from beginning to end, it's kind of been a learning experience throughout. So you kind of learn like, this is what works, this doesn't work. So yeah, I don't know if I would particularly change anything.
I think in terms of our sort of in-app experiences, it's been quite a learning curve. When we brought on Chameleon last year, I had never done any sort of in-app messaging before. Yeah. So it was both kind of learning the ins and outs of that. And there was a lot of trial and error in that process. I think we've hit a really good kind of stride by this point. But maybe the only things I would change is taking more time in the beginning to like really learn about what our customers want from their in-app experiences. We did do that. We did dive into a bit of customer research there and had some conversations early on with customers who were engaging with the tours, kind of getting their feedback, incorporating that in. But I probably would have extended that research period a little bit longer just to be even more informed with the strategy that we moved forward with. I think it sort of evolved naturally over time. And obviously there was the need for speed and getting things shipped out the door quickly. It doesn't always give you the luxury of a very long research period. So it's sort of a double-edged sword there, but that's the main thing that I can think of changing.
Yeah, that was something as you're talking, Rachel, and you just hinted at it, is that I have to imagine that internally, there was pressure to maybe not spend too much time getting lost in the weeds in some of these things. Because I think product tours and even in-app guidance a lot of times has a long tail in terms of how it pays off. And it's not like, it's like, oh, we did this thing and we saw 20 demos get booked that day. Or influence closed one exactly in this way. There's almost this need to trust that, hey, this is positively impacting the buying journey and we're seeing how this is going to translate into adoption and decreased churn and overall NPS scores and all of that. So I admire the amount of, because I see all the 7C that feels like it had to have taken a tremendous amount of time. And I just respect that time investment that went into it. And I have to imagine there was a lot of outside pressure to maybe do it and get it done fast and not spend too much time. Like, you have to just ship it and see what happens rather than try to get it perfect. So, well, guys, thank you so much. This was such a treat. Thank you for making the time. If people want to keep up with you and what you're up to at Vitally, where can they find the three of you? Jeff, you want to go first?
Yeah. LinkedIn. I think my URL is IN/JeffChase1. So if you want to find me, that's literally my URL on LinkedIn. That's pretty much it for my socials. But you can follow, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing as a team also through the Vitally handle. You know, that's where if you're interested in customer success, and we alluded to in this, you know, call today too, like, we're a product marketing team using Vitally. It's a customer success platform, but it can also be leveraged as a customer data platform. We're working very closely with a lot of marketing teams and other adjacent teams, showing them how we're using it. Which is really useful as you're kind of building that collaboration that product marketing teams generally do have with other teams across the organization. So if you want to see some of those insights from us and how the product's evolving, follow us over there. But also the three of us share a lot of the things that we're sharing in the space, whether it's what Vitally is doing or what we're doing from a product marketing perspective.
Cool. Mary, Rachel, same thing. It sounds like LinkedIn and Vitally.
LinkedIn is the way. Yep.
LinkedIn. Yeah. I'm not as active as the two of them, which to my dismay, but LinkedIn is the place.
We will try to nudge you to become more active. I probably spend too much time on there. So don't take my influence. Clearly you're focusing on your work and actually getting the work done. So that's great. Well, thank you again, guys. So great to meet the three of you. We'll chat soon.
Thanks, Colin.
Yeah, thanks so much, Colin.
Nice meeting you.
For everyone still tuned in, thanks so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please help us spread the word to other product marketers. Thanks again and have a great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are.